We've reached Luke chapter 7. A remarkable story. Jesus has been teaching the people. There's been a lot of teaching going on. And now he goes back to, which is for the moment his base in Galilee, a place called Capernaum. When Jesus had finished saying all these sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. There's a centurion's servant, whom his master valued highly, was sick and about to die. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him. "This man," they said, "deserves to have you do this, because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue." So Jesus went with them. He was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to say to him, "Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. And that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." Now, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. And turning to the crowd following him, he said, "I tell you, I have not found such great faith even in Israel." Then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. Jesus was only surprised by faith twice in the Bible. Only twice was Jesus dumbstruck by faith. And they couldn't be more contrasting. They were both in Galilee, both in cities that Jesus knew well. One was in Nazareth, the other in Capernaum. I'm going to put them on the screen now, the two verses that tell us when Jesus was amazed. Mark chapter 6, verse 6, and Luke 7, verse 9. In Mark 6, it says, Jesus was amazed at their lack of faith. And Jesus went around teaching from village to village. He left them. He left them in Nazareth. He was astounded at their lack of faith. And now in Capernaum, he's astounded by so much faith from a pagan. Isn't that just an astounding contrast? The Jews, Jesus' own townspeople, had so little faith, he was astounded. An unbeliever, a pagan, had so much faith that Jesus was astounded. Bible's telling us something there. Faith is not an abstract belief. Faith in Jesus governs how we react in a crisis. It opens or shuts doors to God's blessing. A friend of mine, a colleague, his wife took very seriously ill with something like septicemia, and she was in intensive care. And it was very much touch and go whether she would live or die. And everyone was praying, and she survived, and she got better, and she lived to a ripe old age. But afterwards, he said to me, he said, "You know, Peter, do you know what I learnt? Peter, how fragile we are. How fragile, you know, how weak is our faith. How little faith we have. Because when my wife was ill, I almost stopped praying. I was just rushing around. My head was full of thoughts and fears and anxieties. My faith, Peter, was so weak in a crisis. Faith governs how we react in a crisis. And there are two marvels in this story. The first marvel is of unexpected faith. But there's a second marvel. It's the marvel of unlimited authority. Unexpected faith, unlimited authority. Actually, I think there's a third marvel as I look at that, which is my own ability to look down my noses at other people and not expect anything of them. Actually, that's kind of a third marvel as I looked at this and thought. But let's just take a look at the unexpected faith. Where would you put this centurion in your chart of belief and unbelief? You know, on the spectrum of belief and unbelief, where would he stand? The trouble is, we're too familiar with the story. We've read it, we know it, we know the ending, and that ruins it for us. The more I prepared for this, the more I just tried to get into this man's life. He was clearly from a pagan background. He presumably had rejected that pagan background. He was no longer a practicing pagan. He'd certainly come to see its limitations, but he was still not officially a follower of God. He was probably in the class the Jews of the day called God-fearers. He'd come to respect and love the much of the teaching of the Jewish religion, but he had not become a Jew. He was not following all the laws. He had not yet had a close encounter with a sharp knife, which marked you out as a Jew. He'd not gone through the conversion process. He'd not gone through the official conversion process. He was still technically an outsider. He was on the fringe of the Jewish religion. He did not obey all the rules by any means. He was also a soldier in a world of atrocities. He was a soldier in a world where there was no Geneva Convention, where a soldier's power was absolute. A Roman soldier could make you carry his baggage for a mile, only for a mile, which is where Jesus' saying comes from, an extra mile, going the extra mile. But Roman soldiers, or soldiers in general, had immense power in those days. He was a centurion. If you read the commentaries, they say that originally that meant he would have commanded 100 men, but that had long since ceased to be the case. It was just a rank in the army, pretty much equivalent to our captain. Polybius, the Roman writer, talks about the centurion, that they should be not seekers after danger, but men who can command, steady in action and reliable. They ought not to be over anxious to rush into the fight, but when hard proved, they must hold their ground and die at their post. That's what's expected of a captain, of a centurion in the army. Not dissimilar, perhaps, to a captain in a modern army. He was probably not in the Roman army, by the way. It's possible, but there's very little archaeological evidence for Roman activity or Roman base in Capernaum. He was probably an army captain in the army of Herod and Antipas, the sort of national army. And he had slaves. The biblical word can mean slave or servant, but one suspects, by the way, he commands his servants around, that they were probably technically slaves. But he cared about this one. Matthew's account uses a word that suggests the slave or the servant was a very young man. And he was sympathetic to the Jews. Now, in the ancient world, generally, Jews were loathed because they were accused of atheism, because they didn't have images of their gods. And they weren't greatly appreciated in the ancient world. But this guy loved the Jewish nation, although he clearly was not one of them. And a fair number of people in the ancient world, a fair number of people of a pagan background, were attracted by the fact that the Jews only had one God. It seemed to make more sense to them to have just one God. And they liked the strict morality, they liked the honesty, they liked the discipline of the Jewish religion. And they were attracted to it, although they didn't become Jews themselves. They would turn up at the synagogue and join in the worship and listen to the teaching. And there was a synagogue in Capernaum. Now, as I tried to get into the guy's mind, just bear with me, because there's a bit of maybes here. We're not sure of the details. I'm just basing on my own experience down the years, just trying to get inside the man's head. What drew this guy to the synagogue? I wonder, it's just supposition, I wonder, did he marry a Jew? Was his wife Jewish? Because that would kind of put him into a category of people I know quite well. People, men who respect the church, whose wives are practicing devout Christians, but the men remain on the fringe. They don't do church very easily. They're not comfortable with a cup of tea and standing around talking. They're not comfortable in that sort of church environment. So they remain respectful. They support their wife. They support the church. One of our church plants. Susan and I were church planters in Brazil for a number of years. And one of our church plants, there was a Japanese guy. Brazil is full of people of Japanese descent. Long story, I won't go into it now. He married a Christian lady. And he was a builder, which is really good when you're church planting, is to have a builder somewhere in your congregation. He very rarely came to church. He still kept his little Japanese kind of shrine to his ancestors in his house. He never accepted fully the Christian faith, but he was tremendously sympathetic to us, and we were building a church at the time, not just by the people, but we needed a building. The church had been meeting in our living room and outgrew it. Long story, but it did. So Susan and I were more than grateful to have to move the church out of our living room into a proper building. And just what a blessing this man was. And I just wonder if in some ways, not in all ways, this man was a bit like that. Perhaps his wife was a member of the synagogue. And because of that, he'd been drawn in and respected it. Something, someone had attracted. Maybe he had a good friend who was a rabbi based on that synagogue. I don't know, who just drawn him in. But he was sympathetic. And when it came to building the synagogue, he helped build it. He contributed greatly to its construction. We've actually found the remains of a synagogue in Capernaum. It dates from 200 AD because the original was destroyed by the Roman army. We wonder if the new synagogue wasn't actually built on the foundations of the old. It's possible, but we don't know. Neither do we know how many synagogues there were in Capernaum. We suppose one, but there might have been more. So some things are not entirely clear. But he helped build the synagogue. Now, that was fine. His superiors wouldn't have had a problem with that. Keeping the Jews happy was a good thing. Gibbon, the historian, comments dryly, the various modes of religion which prevailed in the Roman world were all considered by the people as equally true, by the philosophers as equally false, and by the magistrates as equally useful. So if it kept people under control, if it kept people happy, go ahead and do it. And he helped. He helped build the temple in Capernaum. Now, you say, wait a minute. Just wait a minute. The synagogue in Capernaum. We've come across this before, haven't we? Haven't we met this before? Haven't I read something about the synagogue in Capernaum? Well, you have actually. In Luke chapter 4, verse 31, we read a story. Jesus went down to Capernaum, a town in Galilee, and on the Sabbath began to teach the people. They were amazed at his teaching because his message had authority. Interesting how this word's going to reoccur in Capernaum again, isn't it? He had authority. In the synagogue there was a man possessed by a demon, an evil spirit. He cried out at the top of his voice, "Ha! What do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." "Be quiet," Jesus said sternly. "Come out of him." Then the demon threw the man down before them all and came out without injuring him. All the people were amazed and said to each other, "What is this teaching? With authority and power he gives orders to evil spirits and they come out." And the news about him spread through the surrounding area. Happened in the synagogue in Capernaum. And I'm asking, was it this centurion's synagogue? Was it the one he'd helped to build? Is it the one that he used to go to occasionally? I'm sure he wasn't a regular there, but was he there? I'm speculating now. I'm making this up. And it's significant that all the commentaries and all the preparation I read, no one suggested this. It's only me, so I must be wrong. But I'm just captivated by the idea that maybe that was one of the Saturdays the centurion was there. You can't prove me wrong, can you? And he's there with his wife. And this guy has been troublesome down the years. This guy has been a pain in everyone's neck. And that Saturday, he sees this guy change. And the guy's whole character changes after that. And the Capernaum says, "Now that," and the centurion says, "Now that's what I call authority. I recognize that voice of command. That is the kind of guy I could obey." Do you see where I'm coming from? The centurion knew what had happened. He knew what had happened in Capernaum. He knew what had happened. And so he sends the Jewish elders to intercede for him. Now Matthew says that he himself went, but I think that's Matthew's shorthand for saying he sent messengers. He sent the Jewish elders. He himself, not being Jewish. You see, the strict Jews wouldn't touch a non-Jew. The very strict ones. They wouldn't. They wouldn't have anything to do with them. And he was seeing Jesus as a very great leader. So he didn't feel, because he didn't know all the prayers. He didn't keep all the Jewish rules. He knew he wasn't a proper Jew. He knew that. So he sends some of the Jewish elders to Jesus and says, "Look, Jesus, this guy, he's not Jewish. He's not one of us. But he's a great friend. He's been so helpful to us." And as Jesus comes near, the centurion sends his friend saying, "Don't come into my house." Now, the reason for that was simple. Jews, the very strict Jews, were not allowed inside the house of a Gentile. They weren't allowed to eat with them. They wouldn't even go inside their house. And the centurion knew that Jesus would take flack from the Jewish authorities, from the strict Jews, the Taliban of the Jews, the Pharisees. They would criticize him for entering his house. He wants to spare Jesus the criticism. And he knows that Jesus doesn't need to come into his house. He knows now who is the Lord of the world. He knows who has authority. He knows who can command and who can make things change. He knows it's Jesus. So he says, Jesus, look, you're only going to get into trouble for coming to my house. I don't want you to get into trouble. I don't want you to take criticism from the religious leaders. But Jesus, just say the word. You just wouldn't expect to find faith there in this man, would you like that? But it was there. I've been struck many times through my life not to judge people. People are on a spiritual faith journey, and where they are at different points, you can never tell, and they can surprise you. I had a wonderful friend in one of the cities I worked in, a real leader, a layman, a lecturer in university, and had a high position in the government. And we were trying to do a deal to swap a piece of church land for another bit of land. I won't go into details. But this guy said, no problem, Peter. I'll set up a meeting with this particular guy who was one of the top businessmen in the States, had a massive construction industry, had something of a reputation as being a bit of a sharp character, had a bit of a reputation of some underhand stuff. My friend Sirius said, Peter, come on, let's go and meet him. So we had a meeting. So we're around the table. I'm sitting around the table with these top business people now. And I'm feeling completely out of I feel like a fish out of water. These guys have got so much money, so much power. And there's me, little me in the middle of it all. Yeah? And Sirius, without warning, of course, being a friend, says, oh, before we begin, we got my friend that's a pastor here. Just going to ask him to begin this meeting in prayer, if that's all right with you all. And I'm thinking, whoa, you know. So as I begin to pray, I just begin getting through my mind pictures of all the guys, this people, this man employs. So in my prayer now, I follow this vision that's going through my mind. So I start praying for the man and his business. I start praying for all his bricklayers, for all his labourers, for all his carpenters. I start praying for the children whose bread and whose clothes and schooling comes from their job in this firm. I begin praying for the health of this firm, for all the poor people in the city who work for him and are sustained by him. The prayer just follows that way. I finish the prayer, I open my eyes, look up, the guy's sitting there with tears streaming down his face. And he said, after that prayer, Pastor, this is going to be a good meeting. I'd never expected to find faith there, but it was there. People on a faith journey never put them off. Can I take a complete diversion at this point and apologize to you if you've ever been offended by a Christian who's looked down their nose at you and preached fire and brimstone at you and made you feel that big? I apologize. I'm sorry. There are people out there who do that. And I just want to say, that's not how it's meant to be. That's not how Jesus was. You find Jesus happily going along to the house of this centurion. And if you are a hellstone, a hellfire and brimstone preacher, would you please stop? Because you're not doing any good at all. You're just putting people off. You're just turning people away, the very people you should be drawing close to. Unexpected faith. You find faith in this man that you don't find anywhere else on the pages of the New Testament in the Gospel stories. And then you find unexpected faith meets unlimited authority. As Jesus is approaching, he stopped from going into this house. Now, Tom writes, the commentary writer, in his commentary says, if we see God's authority at work in Jesus Christ as any less absolute than that of a military officer, we are, according to this passage, not only mistaken, but lacking in faith itself. I've never had the privilege of serving in the armed forces. I know some of you have, some of you are. And you know what it is to have authority. I've watched all the programs, I've watched all the films, I've seen all the films, I know what it's like from a distance. But the truth is, a word of command is a word of command. Isn't that right, Tony? A word of command is a word of command. And that's it. That's the authority. That's where the authority lies. And if the word of command comes, it happens. And the centurion says, Jesus, you have authority. You have authority. There is nothing that can resist your word. There is no spiritual power. There is no sickness. There is no illness. There is nothing in this planet. There is no storm that can resist your word of authority. Jesus, you don't need to step inside my living room. All you need to do is command, and my servant will be healed. Tom Wright says, we should have no hesitation in asking, is Jesus Lord of the world or is he not? A trailer for a forthcoming sermon. Now, on the screen, Psalm 2, verse 8. Coming soon in a chapel near you, in a fortnight's time, in the evening, Alpha Sunday, evening sermon. Text, ask of me and I will make the nations your inheritance. This is God the Father talking to God the Son. Okay? Ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. God will give the nations to Jesus, because he's given authority to Jesus. Do you see? Do you see where we're going? Jesus has authority. If Jesus says the word, I'm healed. If not, I'm not. But the authority is his. If Jesus declares me saved, then no power can stop it happening. No government can deny it. No scorn or cynicism can change it. If Jesus says, I'm saved, I'm forgiven, I'm redeemed, then I am, and nothing can change that. No one can change that. No one can deny it. You can do what you like to me, but you can't take away from me the fact that if Jesus, the Lord, declares me his, then I belong to him forever. And nobody can take him. Take me out of his hand. If Jesus declares me healed, then no disease can resist. He is the one in charge. There is no other. And I'm reading this story and I'm saying, I'm thinking of Psalm 2, this sermon that's coming up in a fortnight's time. I'm saying, Jesus, you are the Lord of North Wales. You are the Lord. You are. There is no other. You have the authority. And I'm praying, as I was sort of going through all this in my mind, okay, I'm start praying to God the Father. God the Father, give North Wales to your son. Give North Wales to Jesus. Give it back to Jesus in a new way. Give Bangor to Jesus. Give Gwynedd to Jesus. Give Ynys Môn to Jesus. Give the people to Jesus. Give them, because he has authority. Put my country, my people, under the authority of Jesus, and let his will be done.